Hello, this is Sandra Ferguson with the Friday, April 13th, 2018 edition of the News Gazette. And we'll begin on the front page with a piece from the University of Illinois called Speaking Up. Officials defend chief event restrictions, lift them for free speech talk, by Julie Worth Urbana. This time, everyone is invited. The next critical conversation at the University of Illinois on free speech will be a public event with no registration required and no media restrictions, the campus said Thursday. The UI had initially said no recording would be allowed when two acclaimed First Amendment scholars, Emeritus Law Professor Jeffrey Stone of the University of Chicago and Law Dean Erwin Chemerinsky of the University of California at Berkeley, take the stage Tuesday at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. It was unclear until Thursday exactly what the press arrangements would be, prompting Illinois Press Association General Counsel Don Craven to comment, "The irony is terrific." But that's because the campus hadn't secured permission from the two speakers to record their remarks and wanted to announce the free speech event along with the first conversation on the Chief Illiniwek issue held April 10th, said UI spokeswoman Robin Kaler. "I'm glad they recognized the problem and are taking steps to fix it," Craven said Thursday. The chief event, which had a different format from the upcoming public talk, did not allow audio or video recording, and reporters weren't allowed inside. The opening speaker's remarks were broadcast in an adjoining room for any overflow crowd and reporters, but not the small group conversations that followed. The event, held in a meeting room at the Eikenberry Commons housing complex, was only open to those who had registered because the format was designed to encourage meaningful conversations by people on both sides of a difficult topic, away from any protests or media, Kaler said. "This is a very emotional issue for a lot of people," she said, "and it was hard to get participants to agree to sit down with people they disagreed with on a very, very contentious issue," Kaler said. "We wanted to make sure that we didn't add complications to that." Photography also was prohibited inside or outside the meeting room, even though the campus had its own photographer there and provided some pictures to the press. Somewhat cynical. Kaler said the campus tried to accommodate the media, but this was not a media event. This was for the benefit of our community to try to begin a conversation and healing and exploring of a path for forward so we can get past where we have been stuck for 10 years. Craven was unconvinced. "You would think that these are billed as issues of importance to the entire campus, that they would not be constructed in such a way that the university controls who's there," he said. "There's nothing that says they violated the law," Craven said. "But when universities start closing people out of meetings so they can talk about what they want to talk about and discuss issues like Native American imagery with 200 of their closest friends, I find myself being somewhat cynical about that." But Kaler said, "This event was not designed as a conversation for the entire universe. We've tried that many times over the past few years, and it was not helpful. This event was about the people in that room," she said. "The campus wanted to try a new approach using trained facilitators and expert speakers to provide context and bring participants with divergent viewpoints closer together," she said. Many of those who attended said, "I heard something I didn't know before. I realized that this person is not a horrible person and that they actually have a legitimate point of view," Kaler said. "And that's what we were trying to get at." The other theme that emerged from groups with varied viewpoints was, "It's time to move forward," she said. Kaler said the chief event was not covered by the Open Meetings Act, as no elected officials were involved, and the campus has many talks that aren't necessarily open to the media. "This isn't about making any decisions on how the university might be run," she said. Would we make any decisions about how we move forward without having some conversations that fall under the Open Meetings Act? Highly unlikely. Contentious issue. As for the no taping rule, Kaler said the required paperwork seeking permission to record the speaker's talks wasn't secured beforehand. This was the first event of its kind and on probably the most contentious issue the university faces, and the planning involved lots of delicate consultations about which speakers would be best and how to ensure all perspectives were included, she said. As a result, the format was very fluid and wasn't settled until close to the actual date. Kaler said the campus wants to repeat the experience somehow to engage more people, including alumni, possibly in other locations. That may involve a larger or more public version of the first event, she said. The UI did record the speakers' talks, and it's possible the remarks could be posted online at some point, she said. But the campus could decide against that if they're going to be used at future conversations so participants don't hear them ahead of time, she said. The campus has had other public events where recording wasn't allowed, including talks by Supreme Court justices who worry that clips of their remarks could be taken out of context and affect future cases. UI Law Dean Vikram Amar, who will be moderating Tuesday's free speech event, clerked for the late Justice Harry Blackmun and later invited him to speak at graduation at the University of California, Davis, where Amar was teaching. Blackmun agreed, but insisted that only print media be allowed to cover it, Amar said. The school's chancellor refused and invited Governor Jerry Brown instead, he said. And next, from the Unit 4 schools, the North Champaign Academy proposal, deadline extended, answers to 116 questions due Wednesday, by Lindsay Jones, Champaign. Leaders of a proposed Champaign charter school have received an extension on the homework they were assigned Monday night by the Unit 4 school board. Pressed by board members during Monday's hearing to provide answers to 116 questions about an application lacking in detail, North Champaign Academy founders frequently deferred, asking for the chance to provide clarification later. The deadline set at the meeting of noon today has been pushed back to Wednesday, Unit 4 Superintendent Susan Zola informed NCA in an email obtained by the News Gazette. That's 2 days fewer than NCA asked for, but still came as a relief. In her email to NCA, Zola added, "Please be mindful that this is an opportunity to clarify the proposal submitted by NCA on February 26th. This is not an opportunity to submit a wholly new proposal without the review and public hearing process." Speaking Thursday about the unanswered questions from Monday's marathon of a meeting, NCA Steering Committee Craig Walker said, "I'm not saying the questions were unreasonable. Think about it. If you just figure 116 questions and you give each one 3 minutes of answering, that's 348 minutes, 6 hours. The questions raised Monday by Zola and school board members following their review of the application covered a variety of topics, from the criminal background check process to the plan for teacher prep periods. During a tense moment at Monday's meeting, Board President Chris Kleppel told Walker the NCA's lacking application was the reason the questions were even being asked in the first place. These questions are the answers that could have been provided in this school proposal, Kleppel said. Walker said he would have preferred to have been emailed the questions, but Kleppel later said that part of the reason the 116 questions were asked at the hearing was to make them public knowledge. We were sort of entering them into evidence at that point, Kleppel said Thursday. For now, the district's plan is to provide a written decision about the charter school at a special meeting at 5:30 p.m. May 2nd. That's later than the original timeline, which called for a ruling on April 23rd. And next, from the Big Ten Network Comcast lineup, Big Ten Network Sticking Around in Illinois, by Bob Asmussen. Don't worry, Big Ten fans. Your conference's network is staying on Comcast's list of available channels locally. The Big Ten Network and Market Feed is still available and will continue to be available to our customers in Big Ten states, including Illinois, Comcast Vice President Jack Siegel told the News Gazette on Thursday, as reports circulated about the network dropping BTN altogether. That's only partly true. Comcast is indeed dropping Chicago-based BTN, but only in some out-of-market areas. Comcast, based in Philadelphia, is the country's largest cable provider, owning systems in 49 states and the District of Columbia. Hawaii is the lone state without Comcast. Illinois has more than 500 Comcast systems, including in Champaign-Urbana, Danville, Mahomet, Ogden, Rantoul, St. Joe, and Savoy. The brainchild of Big Ten Commissioner Jim Delaney, BTN turns 11 on August 30th. And next, from the Champaign-Urbana Schools Foundation, a piece called Covering It All, Emmy-winning Urbana grad to be honored locally. Wherever big news is breaking, from the battlefields of Iraq to the mourning town of Parkland, Florida, you're likely to find Susan Kroll. The Emmy Award-winning member of Urbana High School's class of 84 is the coordinating producer for NBC, based in New York City, but frequently dispatched to places like Flint, Michigan, to report on the lead-tainted water crisis, and Norristown, Pennsylvania, where she's now covering the Bill Cosby retrial. Kroll, who will return home this weekend to be honored with the Distinguished Alumni Award from the Champaign-Urbana Schools Foundation, took a break from court to catch up and look back with staff writer Tim Mitchell. What's the one story you've been a part of that touched you like no other? One of the recent stories that touched me the most was the Parkland shooting. I had covered Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, and remember all those itty-bitty caskets. As a journalist, you can't always feel what is happening around you. But the case of Parkland was different. All the students had a connection to what happened. They were 14 years old, just babies, and I couldn't think about it without breaking up. They are right in front of you, and you give them a voice. We were a part of that. How about the story you're proudest of? During the Iraq War, I was with CNN, and I was able to get a military aircraft to fly my team from Kuwait to a town outside of Baghdad. Over 3 months, I worked on relationships, and I had made friends and connections with some of the Marines. Even today, I still have a relationship with many of them. I got them to fly Christiane Amanpour, Nick Robertson, and Jim Clancy to a town outside Baghdad the day the Saddam Hussein statue came down. I was proud of what we were able to do. Speaking of faraway places, tell us about spending a week last summer teaching English to children at an orphanage in Cambodia. I was with a group from Meadowbrook Community Church in Champaign, and it was the first mission I had been on. I realized I need to be giving back to others since so many things had been given to me. I realized I don't have my own children, and I need to help raise this next generation. These kids in Cambodia were beautiful human beings. I was able to be with my mother and share this experience with her. We taught them English, and we sang songs with them. And we talked about God. It was a Christian school in Cambodia. Working at the orphanage was really special. What do you remember most about your Urbana High days? I look back at my time as a cheerleader. I remember cheering during the Urbana Tiger basketball games and all the games we had against Central, Centennial, and Rantoul. I remember the Friday night lights, cheering from the sidelines. Sports was part of the high school experience that made me happy. I have lots of other memories of Urbana High School. I was on the homecoming court. I ran track, running in the middle distances, and relays. Was there a high school teacher who had an especially profound impact on your life? There were two. Rosalind Walker was a PE teacher. She was a beautiful African American woman who was always so supportive to us. Jay Hall was the assistant principal. I remember I really wanted this white coat, but my parents said I could only have it if I had a place to keep it clean while I was at school. I remember going to Jay Hall's office and asking him if I could keep the coat in his office, and he said yes. When my parents learned that, they got me the coat, and every time I wore it, I would keep it in the assistant principal's office. What was it like growing up as then Illini strength coach Bill Kroll's daughter? My dad was a coach at Arizona State and for the Phoenix Suns, and he was the first strength coach at the University of Illinois. He got hired under Ray Elliott and Gary Meller and continued under Mike White. We got used to spending the holidays out of town. We spent one Christmas at the Liberty Bowl and another one at the Rose Bowl and another one at the Peach Bowl. I'm a journalist and we don't get mesmerized by people, but I remember when I was 12 years old, my father introduced me to Roger Staubach. He said, "Roger, this is my daughter, Susie." I went to shake his hand and said, "Mr. Staubach, you have the softest hands." Saturday night, you'll add another honor to your lengthy list. Of all your journalism awards, what's the one you're proudest of? I feel good about my National Headliner Award over our coverage of the capture of Saddam Hussein. We had somebody embedded in the town Saddam was from, in case something happened. One day, he called me and said they got the big one. He said people were smoking cigars and were saying they got Saddam. It was a dangerous place to travel, but we got Nick Robertson and a producer and a crew down there. We were the first team to get there. I am proud of my Emmy for MSNBC for our coverage of the Flint, Michigan water crisis. We did a town hall there. We talked about the health threat to residents. We brought in doctors to help parents and to give them advice. We brought in a plumber to teach people how to fix their pipes. You've been all around the world. Where would you like to go that you haven't been yet? This November, I am going to Namibia in Southwest Africa. I have been to between 125 and 140 countries, but I haven't been there. And we'll turn now to the opinions page and begin with an editorial called "Speculation Surrounds Ryan." House Speaker cites family time for exit, but other factors may have led to his decision. It's been rumored for months now that Republican U.S. House Speaker Paul Ryan was approaching the end of his tenure. The 48-year-old Wisconsin politician made it official Wednesday when he announced that he's volunteering to leave his post, which is third in line of succession for the presidency, and will not be running for re-election. Speculation, of course, is feverish as to why Ryan has chosen to step down. He doesn't want to run for re-election in a year in which Republicans are widely expected to suffer heavy losses at the hands of enraged Democrats. Or he can't stand working with President Donald Trump, whose impulsive actions made governing chaotic and difficult. Or he really does want to spend more time with his children, fearing his kids will remember him only as a weekend dad if he doesn't get out now. All of the above. In addition to the speculation, Ryan's announcement also will unleash the rampant ambition of his GOP colleagues who are interested in succeeding him. They should be careful what they ask for. A resident of Janesville, Wisconsin, Ryan was first elected to the House in 1998. During his tenure, he showed an unusual commitment to policy questions, once stating that his goal was to rewrite the U.S. tax code. Last year, Ryan achieved that goal, at least in part. Republicans, over the unanimous opposition of Democrats, passed a tax bill that not only reduced tax rates across the board, but lowered the corporate income tax and reduced the number and kinds of deductions that dramatically complicate the tax code. It's still too early to say just what the impact of the legislation will be. But as gross domestic product statistics show, the economy continues to pick up steam, reducing unemployment and drawing those who had given up looking for work back into the job market. On other fronts, the Speaker of the House was not so successful, particularly with respect to his interest in restoring Medicare and Social Security to a strong financial footing and bringing this country's out-of-control deficit spending under control. If circumstances had been different, Ryan would never have announced the decision that he did. That's because he ran in 2012 for vice president on the GOP ticket headed by Mitt Romney. Democrats, led by President Barack Obama, won that year, but it was clear from the role Ryan played that he would go on to bigger and better things. That he did. Now, as he prepares to step down from public office to return to private life, there's something else about which to speculate. Is his plan to leave a temporary hiatus? Or does he have another public act left in him, perhaps a run someday for governor or the U.S. Senate from Wisconsin? Those questions, of course, have no answer because they depend on future events impossible to divine. What can be stated with certainty is that Ryan, as he said, gave his job in the U.S. House everything that I have. If it truly is the end of a long public life and the beginning of an equally long private life, that's more than enough to have fulfilled his obligation to his Wisconsin constituents and the people of this country. And next we'll turn to the From Our Readers section and begin with a piece written by Patricia Marlowe of Champaign called GOP/Gunmaker Ties Unsettling. All of us, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, have been agonizing over so many young people being killed by gunfire in this country. Rodney Davis, while he offers thoughts and prayers, continues to cash those checks from the National Rifle Association. If you are going to vote in any election beyond the level of city council, keep this in mind. A vote for a Republican at the state or national level is a vote for the gun manufacturers who pour money into the NRA. That may be hard to hear for many people, but look it up. There are very few Democrats being funded by the NRA. Only four, and none in Illinois. Research shows that after a shooting, such as the one at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, the NRA rolls out the checks. Rodney Davis is willing to take these checks weeks, even days, after school shootings. He is not willing, however, to hold town halls to discuss his constituents' concerns and fears. He ignored, then denied, their invitations to meet on April 5th. I'm old, and it didn't used to be like this. Not perfect, but not like this. If my Republican grandparents and parents were alive today, they would not be able to bring themselves to vote Republican, because a vote for a Republican is a vote for gun manufacturers and their NRA. For those same reasons, I will not consider voting for Davis until he stops taking money from the NRA. And that again was written by Patricia Marlowe of Champaign. The next piece is written by Nick Dalrymple of St. Joseph, and it's called Think About Next Generation. The recent snow was a weather event. Human-caused climate change is still happening now worldwide. The effects of climate change in central Illinois will be wetter springs and falls, making planting and harvesting more difficult. Drier summers will affect crop growth. Indirect effects of climate change include increased worldwide conflict and migration. Sydney residents have an opportunity to help slow climate change. The proposed solar farm south of Sydney will provide renewable energy and reduce the burning of carbon-based fuels. The cost of this to nearby Sydney residents is a background noise of about 45 decibels. Reference.com states the sound of bird calls is approximately 45 decibels. By comparison, the noise inside a library is slightly quieter than 45 decibels, and the sound of a quiet conversation is slightly louder. The advantage to all of us is a better environment for our children and future generations. And that was written by Nick Dalrymple of St. Joseph. And the last from our reader's piece is written by Rachel Dimmock of Savoy, called Lawmakers Should Rethink Town Halls. Congressman Rodney Davis, whose duty is to represent our entire mixed Democratic-Republican district, has consistently refused to attend public town halls, including a recent student-led town hall on gun violence. The congressman says people shouldn't have to listen to the screaming and shouting from people who obviously don't want me to win or even be in this job. He portrays constituents who simply want to hear from him in an open forum as aggressive and unreasonable. Were he actually to meet with us, he'd find that we aren't scary at all. Our numbers include retired and working people across a lot of professions: teachers, nurses, doctors, accountants, graphic designers, librarians, musicians, writers, engineers, secretaries, farmers, small business owners, administrators, counselors, social workers, and more. We are parents, both working and stay at home. We are grandparents. We are students. As for me, I am a stay-at-home mom of two elementary school boys. I volunteer at their school and am active in the PTA. I am an introvert who hates conflict and would much rather stay home than scream and shout at anyone. I would very much like the opportunity to discuss important issues with Davis, but the only interaction I've ever had with him is a canned form letter that doesn't even address the points I've made with his aides when I've called his office. We all deserve a representative who will actually listen to us in order to actually represent us. And that again was written by Rachel Dimmock of Savoy. And we'll now look at the history section. And in area history, in 1918, Paul Kienzel of St. Joseph was arrested after he arrived home in St. Joseph from Camp Marryat, New Jersey, where it was alleged he had deserted. He had obtained a 2-day leave of absence and never returned. In 1968, the two faces of U.S. Senator Charles Percy, that's how leaders of the Save Allerton Park Committee described two different letters that went out to supporters and opponents of the plan to flood part of Allerton Park. "This is a project that I strongly support," Percy wrote in one letter. But in another, he wrote he wanted to explore all the possibilities for a solution that would prevent unnecessary destruction of Allerton Park. In 2003, the Rantoul Public Library District borrowed $325,000 from the village of Rantoul to cover construction costs of a new library in the former Chanute Bowling Alley building. The project won approval for two $150,000 Illinois First grants from State Representative Bill Black, Republican from Danville, and former State Senator Stan Weaver, Republican from Urbana, and a $25,000 Illinois Library grant, but those were just part of thousands approved under Governor George Ryan, for which Governor Rod Blagojevich halted payment. The Urbana Free Library was waiting on more than $500,000 in frozen state grant money for its construction project, also underway. And we'll take a short break now and then return with the second half hour of the Friday, April 13th, 2018 edition of the News Gazette. I'm Sandra Ferguson. Please stay tuned.